Well, hello, friends. Greg Kokel here. Glad to be with you today. And just thinking about a conflict, kind of a firestorm we started a couple of weeks ago, or maybe now. But we have maybe to offer a introduction to my comments here. We have a new thing we're doing, and it's been a lot of fun. And I think it's been pretty effective, too. It's the brainchild of Tim Barnett. It's called Red Pen Logic with Mr. B. That would be Mr. Barnett himself. He used to be a high school teacher and grade papers, and he got this idea to take on the role again, put on his teacher's hat, and then address certain posts in tweets or Facebooks or whatever that entail claims made by critics of classical Christianity. And they may be people that are atheists, for example, or skeptics of some sort. They may be critics from other religions, other religious convictions. They may be those who are broadly within Christendom, but who spin off quite a bit left of Christianity, classical Christianity, known as progressive Christians. It doesn't matter to us. These are issues that are raised in the public square, and we see this as an opportunity to enter into the discussion. And this is a kind of playful way of doing it. We are not trying to be nasty or mean or to berate anybody and make people look foolish, but we are trying to deal with the issues. And sometimes, as you know, when you deal with an issue in public that has been raised in public, and you offer a rejoinder, and your rejoinder is good because the opposing idea is bad, well, I mean, people see that the rejoinder is good and the opposing idea is bad, and that's the point. But the point is not to belittle other people, but to show that the ideas are faulty and the truth matters on these things. So that's the general approach here, and I think most people kind of understand that's how it works in the public realm. And it's not personal for us. We're just dealing with an issue in a playful way, and hopefully in a compelling way. We're not out to destroy people. We're not out to humiliate them. We're not out to shame them. But we are holding their feet to the fire, though the claims that are theologically significant, made publicly, we answer publicly. They enter into the public debate. And so we respond. It means that we don't actually have to contact somebody privately who makes these comments to correct their view or to appeal to them to modify it. Which, by the way, there's a practical matter here. People who go in print with a point of view rarely change the point of view that they have advanced in print. And the more they printed on it, the tougher it is to change their minds. It's just a psychological reality. But what may be changed is not the person's mind, but the person whose ideas have been influenced by the one who made the post. And to a great degree, this is what we're trying to do. And we're trying to demonstrate how a challenge that looks prima facie, that is on its face, to be a solid or a sound or a compelling challenge, how this challenge is compromised, and by showing how it's compromised, we educate Christians. We encourage them if they have wavered in their confidence because of what's been posted. We equip them by showing what's wrong with the challenge and equipping them to help see the problem in that circumstance, but hopefully in a larger way, to help people see how these problems are solved by us. And so in our mission statement, what we say is that we train Christians to think more carefully about their convictions. And so this is a way not only of showing an error in somebody else's view that's significant, the errors are significant, and the view is significant, but we also want to help people see how we got to the answer we did. Oh, you see, this is an example of a straw man argument. They are misrepresenting our view, and then they destroy the misrepresentation, but they're not destroying the view we we actually hold. So there's a principle you can learn from this. A lot of ways where this is a great pedagogical, instructional teaching device. And like I said, we kind of have fun with it too, because Tim's kind of a funny guy. And so this gets posted. Where does it get posted? We have a, I think we've got a Red Pen Logic site, and you can find it. Let me just see here. Check out the new video series called Red Pen Logic with Mr. B, where Tim Barnett picks apart bad ideas in a fun and engaging way. Look for it on the new Red Pen Logic YouTube channel or STR's website and social media channel. So there you have it. Okay, so you can look at it. And what he does is he does a red pen job on the post itself, so there's a graphic with summary little comments, so you get a sense of it. But then he also accompanies it with a video by which he goes through step by step in a serious, that is serious regarding the issues way, but also in kind of a corny, playful way as well in terms of his manner. So it's fun. Got a lot of responses that are good. But we did have a post a couple weeks ago that caused a bit of a firestorm, and we were actually caught a little bit by surprise about it. Now, it might be because the public sector was just a little bit raw in general because of all the other things that are going on. But there was a young lady, I'll spare her name because it's not personal, it's not about her, but a young lady who made a post as a response to her conservative Christian friends who, as she puts it, keep coming at me. And then she makes a number of statements. I'll just read them. I am a Christian, and I believe proselytizing is violence against another. I'm just going to pause for a moment. Does that strike you as an odd thing to say? It did us, of course, since Jesus said, make disciples of all nations, and discipleship entails evangelism. You can't make a disciple out of somebody who's not been evangelized. So does that mean that Jesus was promoting violence? I'm a Christian, and I believe LGBTQ plus people are divine and should lead us. I'm a Christian, and I learn a lot from people who do not share my faith. I'm a Christian, but I don't go to church. I'm a Christian, but I don't believe the Bible is the Word of God. I'm a Christian, and I embrace sex positivity. Sex positivity. It's a hyphenated word. Never heard that before. Sex positivity, but I get the sense of it. Which includes, but isn't limited to, sex outside of marriage. Okay. So these are all the statements that are made in public by this poster, one who posts. And so consequently, we responded in public to it. And all we did was take each statement and compare it to a statement that Jesus made that contradicts the statement that this progressive Christian made. Okay, that's all we did. And it asked a couple of questions, like I did just a moment ago. Was Jesus promoting violence when he gave the Great Commission? And then we asked a question at the end, which is a question that you might be asking yourself when you hear this post from a Christian who says that proselytizing is violence and the Bible's not the Word of God and this person does not go to church and embraces a, I'm not sure exactly how to put it now, the word promiscuous came to mind, but maybe that's an unfair way of putting it, but let's just say a very liberalized view of sex. I think the question that's fair to ask is, if you hold all those views that are contrary to the views of Jesus, then what does it mean to say that you're a Christian? That was the question. We didn't accuse anybody of not being a Christian. We just asked the question because we want people to be thinking about this. Now, this creates quite a firestorm, like you said, like I said, rather, and we got letters and notes and lots of responses. People forwarded this. Many people liked it. Many people hated it. And I want to respond a little bit here about and say something about the response. Now, what I've told you already, what our intention is about Red Pen Logic, and I think we're doing a good job at it, okay? That is, we're working with a way of crafting an educational environment that is to the point, that is compelling, and is effective. And we're especially interested in dealing with ideas that are circulating in our culture and those which are generally expressed in social media. I mean, that's the way the culture talks to each other now, in social media. There are places where people have their own bully pulpit, and they're able to preach to their friends and others that'll listen. Okay, that's great. And that means, though, that they're entering into the public debate, which invites response. And most people know this. And if you look at any Facebook, you look at any Twitter thread, it's all over the internet. And lots of people are given to aggressively challenging the status quo and the convictions of those who represent the status quo, characteristically those in the cultural right, especially Christians, especially conservative Christians. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's fine. Let the best idea win. That's my view. That's great. Let's just talk it out. But and because of that, when a theologically significant post is put into play in the public debate, it's entirely appropriate for us to answer it. Right? And that's what we did here. Now, of course, we're trying to respond to it in a way consistent with our values. We're trying to model both incisive thinking and grace to challenge error, or in some cases foolishness, or in some cases dangerous ideas. And I think these here are theologically dangerous. And we do so by clearly arguing for the truth with legitimate reasons and not with name-calling or resorting to abuse of any kind. We don't believe in that. We don't resort to that because we do not need to resort to that. We have reasons. We have arguments. And I think our arguments are good ones. And if others don't think they're good ones, they can address them and tell us why they're not good ones. Okay? So, like I said, it's not personal for us. We're just dealing with an issue in hopefully a compelling but playful way. We're not out to destroy people. But this is exactly the way a lot of people responded to this particular post. I just want to make an observation, and this is something you can pretty much take to the bank. When you place your ideas in the public square in a compelling way, and the way people respond is to yell at you and berate you and dismiss you or call you names, that is a tell. You know what a tell is? A tell is a giveaway. So if you play cards, somebody else has got a good poker face, they may be giving themselves away with something else, a twitch, a move of the hand, a way they act when they have a bad hand and they're bluffing. These are called tells. And when people respond to an argument, and here I mean a point of view given, supported by reasons, I don't mean a quarrel. When people respond to a thoughtful argument by calling names and heaping abuse on a person instead of addressing the points in play, that's a tell. And it's an indicator that they don't have a case. Because if they had a case, they'd present it. And then let the best argument win. That simple. But we've seen this in spades for years and years and years now. It has just simply become the standard way of responding to ideas a person does not like. They feel completely at freedom and liberty, rather, to pontificate on their own views. But the minute somebody takes exception with it, then they essentially scream bloody murder. And the screaming is metaphorically speaking here, of course, though sometimes not so. And it's in the form of verbal abuse, which does not include addressing the points. But it's a character assassination on the person who disagreed with them. This has become the standard way of dealing with issues now. And it tells you that the other side, in that case, has no argument. Now, it might turn out that the issue that you're addressing does have legitimate responses to your challenge, but the person who's responding to you doesn't know them, or else they would use them. They don't know them, so they resort to these other techniques. So what do we do in a circumstance like that? It would have been tempting for us to go head-to-head with all of the people who challenged us on these points, but we just frankly did not think that would be wise. We lay our ideas out in the public square with our reasons and let people, you know, do what they want with them. We don't have to be defensive, reacting to every single claim that comes up. People can judge for themselves, okay? And what comes to mind when I think of these circumstances is a conference that I was at. Let me think, where was it? It was somewhere in Hungary. And in this particular case, William Lane Craig was giving a seminar. It was a weekend or a week-long thing. There were a lot of speakers there, and I was one of them, but Bill was there as well, and I sat in on his particular seminar. And during the Q&A session, somebody asked him, well, how do you manage when so many people are hostile to you in your debates? And Bill's a very, very ironic public presenter. That is, he's very down to earth. Let's see, that's not the right word. He's very amicable. He's very gracious. He's very friendly. He goes head on with the issues, but he never, ever makes it personal with the other individual. But they make it personal with him. And so the question is, how do you deal with this? And I was, in a certain sense, I was surprised by what I heard Bill say, but it makes perfect sense. He quoted Jesus in Matthew 5 on the Sermon on the Mount. And he said, what I do is I rejoice. Why? Because Jesus said to, here it is, blessed are you when people insult you and persecute you and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward in heaven is great. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. In other words, Jesus is saying, look, you're in good company, which would include not just the prophets he referred to, but Jesus himself. I talked about that last show in Matthew chapter 10. They treated me this way, they're going to treat you this way. Okay? Rejoice, be glad, you're on my team. It's okay. Your reward in heaven is great. So, in fact, Jesus said, beware when people speak well of you all the time. Because if everyone thinks you're doing just fine, then probably something's wrong. Okay. Paul reminded Timothy that all who desire to live godly in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution. Because it is the godliness in their lives that is a testimony against the godlessness in the culture, and people are going to react to that. And that's what happened in this particular post. So, by the way, this trouble that we experience, even the heat we got for that post, which is okay, it's nothing compared to what so many of our true brothers and sisters around the world have been suffering and are suffering now to stand for Christ in their communities. Paul mentions at one point, you have not suffered to the point of shedding blood. There are Christians in the Middle East who are being beheaded rather than recant their faith. They're being beheaded. So, you know, our problem's pretty small by comparison. Nevertheless, we want to rise to the occasion, be gracious. We're even thinking of ways now that we can make Red Pen Logic even less bothersome in ways that we could avoid. I mean, sometimes you find ways that you can say something that would make it a little bit more effective and less troublesome. And so that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to modify, but we're not going to stop doing what we're obliged to do as Christians in the field that we work in. And this is especially true when dealing with others who declare themselves as Christians and then pontificate on clearly un-Christian concepts, concepts they advance that are directly opposed to what Christ said. And like I mentioned earlier, if you have a significant number of beliefs that are contrary to Christ's, then what does it mean when you call yourself a Christian? Fair question. All right, let's take a break and your calls in just a moment on Stand to Reason.
You can take Stand to Reason with you through our mobile apps, available for free from the App Store or the Google Play Store. The Quick Reference app gives you short, easily accessible courses on our most popular topics like tactics, homosexuality in the Bible, morality, the story of reality, and many more. The Stand to Reason app has all our latest content available at your fingertips. You can listen to our podcasts, check the blog, and access timely and practical resources. They're free, so download the apps today on the App Store or the Google Play Store and start carrying Stand to Reason with you everywhere you go. If you enjoy our apps, you can help other people find them by rating them on the App Store or the Google Play Store.
Have you ever wondered how Stand to Reason is able to produce fresh, accessible, and relevant content each week? As a nonprofit ministry, we rely on generous supporters in order to provide the tools and tactics you need to be an effective ambassador for Christ. If you've benefited from this podcast or any of our donor-provided resources, including apps, blog posts, articles, or short videos, consider making a financial contribution to Stand to Reason today. When you visit str.org/donate, you'll find a newly renovated transaction page that makes it easier than ever to show your financial support. It has been an honor providing you with a host of free resources over the past 25 years to help you give voice to the Christian worldview. Please help us to continue on into the next 25 years by making a gift today at str.org/donate.
All right, friends, Greg Hochul here, and I was really bothered. Hurt me to see somebody drop off. I'm not sure if they just got back online here. Yeah, okay, Oliver came back. All right, let's go to Oliver. Oliver, thanks for getting back on. I don't know how you disappeared there, but I'm glad you got back on board. Nice to talk to you. Rockland, Maine, and Oliver.
Yeah.
Hi.
Hi. Yeah, it disconnected for some reason. I don't know what was going on. So my question is on doubt. In the past, I've suffered severely, like, with them, and half the time I don't even know why. Like 90% of the time, it's just almost like the emotion of doubt. And I'm just kind of wondering, like, if I keep like doubting, like this, do I lose my salvation from that? Like, because I know Romans 10:9 is if you confess with your mouth Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you'll be saved. I might have that reversed or something, but what if you, like, doubt that? Maybe not for an intellectual reason at all, but just the emotion of doubt comes up when you think of that or something. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make perfect sense because everybody doubts. Mm-hmm. Everybody doubts. There isn't a person that I know that hasn't had doubts about their own convictions, about the truth of their own convictions. So doubt is not a Christian problem. It is a human problem. And it's a human problem because there are issues that of great significance, of great moral weight and philosophic and theological weight that we have to address, but we are limited in our ability to know thoroughly and completely. This doesn't mean we can't know. I think we can know. And in fact, if there aren't things that we know for a certainty, we'd be dead in a day, you know. But it does identify that there are certain liabilities. So when we are running into Doug Guyvett called the pockets of agnosticism, that is little things inside of us where we say, well, I'm just not entirely sure. That can throw us for a loop if we have been reared on a point of view that says we can never question or doubt our own convictions, and if we fall into doubt, then that jeopardizes our salvation. I actually don't think it does. I think doubt is normal. And doubt is something that I've experienced at different times in my life on different issues. So I think you mentioned earlier when I saw your name come up here, resurrection was one thing that you were uncertain about or that you had doubts about. Is that right?
And, well, it wasn't for an intellectual reason. It's like, did Jesus really rise? I know the evidence for it and stuff like that. It's just, I've seen Gary Habermas videos and stuff like that, and I don't really struggle intellectually. It's just, it doesn't really make any sense. It's just the emotion of doubt. It's not like I've dealt with arguments. I've debated them on like Pal Talk. I'll talk on there with atheists and stuff, and they have no. I've never really had anything I can really, or that God didn't provide an answer to. I should say, it's just emotional. Like just the emotion of doubt will hit me.
And sure, I mean, and there not, are
these they hit hard too. Like for a while it was happening for like months. And I'd just be, like, kind of sitting on my bed or, like, laying on the floor, like, groaning because it hurt. Like, physically hurt.
Yeah.
And mentally hurt. Like, it was, I don't even understand why it was happening. You know?
Well, the reason why it happens is because you're a human being. I mean, to put it bluntly and simply, okay? Because it is a, like I said, it's not a Christian problem. It's a human problem, okay? So just to kind of put that in its proper perspective, I also want to mention, well, you mentioned emotional doubts. So you're making a distinction between doubts that are rational and doubts that are emotional. And doubts that are rational would be, I don't know if this thing about Christianity is true because I have good reasons to question its legitimacy. That's not what's going on here. It's just something else that's emotional. And Gary Habermas has written about doubt. Actually, Brett Kunkel has a good piece on doubt, and I don't know where it's at, but he talks about it in his talks, and he's probably written on it too. So I would maybe check that out. But he makes this distinction between emotional doubt and rational doubt, and sometimes we just have these emotional misgivings that arise in our heart for reasons that are unrelated to facts that we can come up with, all right?
Yeah.
And, I mean, I wish I could remember everything that Brett said in his article, and I can't. But I will offer this. For me, when I experience periods of doubt or doubts about particular things theologically, I have to go back to my reasons for why I think the world view itself is compelling. It's well substantiated. And that helps to secure me on the rational side. And when I'm secured on the rational side, then I can kind of just acknowledge that, my emotions are going to go up and down with regards to Christianity, based on all kinds of things that are outside of my control. Are you married?
No.
Okay, well, if you were married, you'd experience the same thing in your marriage. The problem is that for some people, they think if I lose passion or a sense of being in love with my spouse, then that means I married the wrong person. I got to find somebody else. No. This is just the way human emotions work. They go up and they go down, they go up and they go down, okay? And this is true in marriage. It's true in every human relationship. It's also true in our faith experience, if you will, in our relationship with God. And there are times when God just seems completely absent. C.S. Lewis wrote about this in the Screwtape Letters, that the closest thing that humans can come to is a kind of a undulation. He called it the law of undulation. We go up and we go down. We go up and we go down because we have, the way he characterized it, we have one foot in eternity and one foot in time. And so that makes us split and up and down kind of people. What I have tried to learn to do is not to trust the downs or even the ups too much, knowing that, you know, this too shall pass. And I want to add something else to this that's really important because it's part of my own conviction. I am safe because of the grace of God. God's grace keeps me safe. And I am not going to be victimized by vicissitudes in my convictions because I can count on God's grace. Okay, I know he's there for me, and I don't have to have it all perfect, and I'm not going to be punished for questioning or wondering or being uncertain. What matters here, and this is the key, is where, in a certain sense, a strange way to put it here, but is where you place your bets. Where you place your bets, okay?
Yeah.
So you could be, let's go back to the marriage illustration, you know, you might be at your wedding day and have doubts, not sure, cold feet. That's why they have best men to keep the groom in place, you know. But you can still go through and place your bet, place your money on the relationship by saying, I do, and then sticking with your decision. You know, yeah. My younger brother was the one who pointed out in Proverbs, it says, the eyes of a man are never satisfied. That is, even when you got great marital relationship, you're still going to be tempted outside of that. The eyes of a man are never satisfied. And I think this has broader application to the world of ideas, you know, that we are going to be vulnerable to other ideas. I remember thinking, you know, when you read something that a skeptic writes, and there's a chill that goes up your spine, and the chill is represented by the thought or stimulated by the thought, wow, that's a good point. I don't know how to answer it. What if I'm wrong? And it's that what if I'm wrong thing that's a scary thought. But, of course, I have no good reason to think that I am wrong on these issues because I have a host of reasons establishing the Christian worldview. So what I can do in that scared moment is just write it off to the emotions of the moment and then just move forward.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm safe because of the grace of God, and I am still placing my bet, so to speak, and that's what I mean by faith. I'm putting my trust in Jesus, even though I have these uncertainties. Remember that guy with the demon-possessed boy? He said to Jesus, if you can, please help my son. He said, if I can, all things are possible to him who believes. And he says, I believe, help my unbelief.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an acknowledgement there that we sometimes have a foot in both camps. But that does not limit Jesus from doing what he needs to do. In fact, he did deliver that young boy from demonic possession. And so I guess what I want to say more in kind of summary here, Oliver, is that... is that doubt is really normal. It's not unusual, and you should not be faulted for having it. And sometimes the doubt is rational, and it gives you an opportunity to address that by getting answers to your challenges. That's one of the reasons we're here. Sometimes there's no rational basis for it. It's just an emotional thing, and that also happens in all kinds of circumstances, including relationships that are important, like marriage. And but that doesn't have – because we have – emotional doubts, emotionally driven uncertainties or up and down doesn't mean we have to change where we placed our bets, so to speak. We don't have to change our commitment to our spouse. We don't have to change our commitment to the Lord because there's no good reason to. There's just an emotional fluctuation, which is pretty normal.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Greg. You've calmed my spirit, I guess I could say.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, but you know, you'll face another uprising of the emotions, you know, again in the future. And just remember the same: it's okay. This too shall pass. No worries. Just keep moving ahead. Keep putting your trust in Christ. You can keep asking the questions. It's fine. We'll do our best to answer them. But I don't want you to be deep sixed just because you're experiencing doubt in your life. And try to find Brett Kunkel's piece on doubt. I'm sure that he's written on it. He speaks on it. I'm sure you'll find something that he's written on it as well. Just Google it up and see if you can find it. All right?
All right. Yeah, I'll give that a try. Thank you, Greg.
You're so welcome, Oliver in Rockland, Maine. I appreciate your call. All right. Let's see. I think we got a break coming up here. Why don't we take it quickly, and then we'll go to Tom in Montana and on progressive Christianity. I got a couple more thoughts, too, about COVID. So we'll do that in a moment here on Stand to Reason.
Would you like Greg, Alan, or Tim to come speak at a location near you? If so, just send a quick email to darcy@str.org to schedule them today. Our speakers are accomplished and compelling presenters who address, from a biblical standpoint, topics like abortion, homosexuality, and evolution, as well as apologetics, theology, and evangelism. They're available to teach lectures and seminars, preach sermons, and lead workshops at single events or weekend-long conferences. Their aim is to help Christians like you effectively engage the culture around you with knowledge, wisdom, and character. To learn more, just go to str.org and click on the training tab at the top of the page.
You know, if you've gained anything from listening to Stand to Reason, I'd really be thrilled to hear it from you. I love to take your questions, of course, but I also want your feedback. So here's what you can do. Head over to iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts and leave us a rating and a review. That kind of thing really helps us to get the word out so more ambassadors for Christ can find the show and become equipped to stand confidently. And you never know, I might just give you a shout out on the air to show you my appreciation for your positive review. I value you as a faithful listener. I look forward to reading what you think about the show. Thanks. All righty, Greg Kokel here, back at you, Stand to Reason, and let's go to Tom in Montana. Tom, welcome to the show.
Hi, Greg. Thank you. Had a question. Well, a lot of the things you've been talking about tonight feel like they kind of might add into this or help with this. We have had a change in our pastors at our church.
Uh-huh.
And our pastor, I've had a chance to spend some time, just one-on-one time with him recently, and he made some comments and claims that made me feel uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense that they were very critical of our president, and I was like, okay, that's fine. Yeah, I don't care how you vote. It was just the actual claims, and so it made me think further about what our faith mission was, our statement mm-hmm. for our church was, and I called our. I don't know if this was okay or not, but I called our previous pastor, who I love dearly, and asked him how I should address this or go forward with this, and he was pretty cautious about it.
He was cautious about weighing in against the pastor that followed him.
Correct.
Is that what you mean?
Yeah, it was. Huh. Because he has made, he and his wife have made comments on our social media page that, we're praying for you and all this, and we love you, and all these different likes and things for things that are said.
For the new pastor.
Correct.
Uh-huh.
But they had not heard the things I had heard.
Right.
One-on-one. And I shared some of those things with them. Like, and these are talking points in the liberal TV or liberal news sources, and I tried to have a discussion and it was calm, it was fine, it was okay. He you know, he was glad I agreed with him on certain things, or I was open mm-hmm. to things. But then I looked into our faith statement, and it was just very vague.
Yeah,
it didn't, and so I don't know if this is okay. Maybe it's totally fine. And I wanted to ask you, should we be very specific when it comes to the issues that are facing our, you know, in our worldview, that the answer
is yes. It is when it comes to spiritual things, substantive, foundational spiritual things, we need to be very clear on what our convictions are, what is true, and then what we promote as true. Okay? So if you have a set of convictions, let's just call it classical Christianity for the moment, and you are with a pastor who seems to be making statements that diverge from classical Christianity, maybe the implication that, well, Jesus is our way, but other religious people have their ways too, and so who are we to judge them? That might be a way of promoting, affirming our own views, but also promoting a religious pluralism at the same time. Well, gee, that's not the way Jesus put it. You know, he said, all who came before me are thieves and robbers. He said, the gate is narrow that leads to life and broad that leads to destruction. Few are those who find life. Many are those who find destruction. Those kinds of things. So Jesus didn't believe that. So what is it the pastor's getting at when he makes a comment like that? Now, this is the kind of thing you must get a very clear answer about, because it's really important. Certainly, there are theological issues that are secondary or tertiary, and pastors, just like me, I'm not a pastor, but just as me as an individual Christian thinker, have not worked out entirely, you know? So I may not know or have confidence in a particular point. Now, maybe here or there or whatever. But when it comes to the foundational things, the central things, we have to be completely clear. We don't want to be ambiguous. So I'm not sure what the particulars were that you heard from your current pastor that gave you pause, but it's entirely legitimate to ask for clarification from your pastor. And it seems to me it's entirely legitimate for your former pastor to weigh in on things that matter. So if your former pastor is aware of something your pastor has been teaching that's just simply not right in a big way, then it's incumbent upon him, as far as I'm concerned, to warn you about the error. Paul warns people about error all the time when the error is significant. If it's not that significant and it's, you know, it's within the pale, that's not a problem. But there are a lot of churches that are listing left theologically right now.
Can I ask you something else, or throw something else in there that, I mean, that you might be able to add to?
You may.
When you say that, the claims that were made, would you like to hear them?
Are you asking me if I'd like to hear them?
Correct.
Yeah. Why don't you? Yeah. Go ahead and tell me.
Well, so for one thing, he brought this out in our time together that he does not think our president is fit to serve.
Okay, that's a separate issue. His opinions about the president are not on the table here, because those are personal opinions, political opinions that are not related to theological points. So if he
Correct.
Thinks the president's not fit to serve, he's welcome to that. I wouldn't question your pastor's ability to serve you spiritually if he thought that the president was not fit to serve. Okay, that's not a problem. What theologically was the issue, if any?
He made then some comments about, with the COVID situation that he has actually enjoyed, and he said it in a way, I understood it. You know, I'm not going to make it sound like it was different. That goes, okay. I haven't had, he goes, actually, you know, I found it very comforting because I haven't had to prepare for a Wednesday night Bible study. I haven't had to prepare for Friday morning men's prayer breakfast, or Sunday school.
I have mixed feelings about those comments. On the one hand, I'm chuckling because I understand it. It makes things a lot easier. I mean, I haven't gotten on a plane to work for 4 months. You know, traveling is challenging. It's a big part of what I do, but I haven't had to do that. You know, so I've done a lot of things online, but it makes my life a lot easier. Now, I personally would rather go before an audience because I think I have a greater impact there, and it's more fun, and it's helped stand to reason more in a lot of reasons. But I'm sympathetic to a statement like that. Wow, it's been a lot easier for me. Okay. However, the question isn't whether it's easier for him, but whether he is able to accomplish his ministerial responsibilities, fulfill his ministerial calling as a Christian pastor more effectively from behind a screen than in person with his people. And I have heard some pastors have said, I just heard it the other night, that, I kind of like this better because it's easier. Well, you don't have a job. You have a calling if you're a pastor. And so, and I have a calling here at Stand to Reason after a fashion. It's not just a job. And so I'm thinking, well, this is an easier way for me to do my job, get paid. That's not the issue. The question is, what is the best way to have an impact on people for the sake of Christ and for the kingdom? And that may, and if this COVID thing makes it harder for me to have an impact, then I don't want it, even if it makes it easier for me to do my job.
Yeah.
And that's the concern. If he's just joking, fine, I get it. If he's really serious, that troubles me, because then it makes me wonder, do you see this as a calling or just a job?
And honestly, I see it more as the joking part of it. Now that the church is opening and we do have services being held, but we also have video available to those people that are
sure.
still...
Yeah, well, that's great. Well, so far I haven't heard anything of substance, theological substance, that causes me to suspect that your pastor is leaning so-called progressive, okay? I mean, there may be other things, but those things don't trouble me in that regard.
That's great to hear then. The last thing I would ask is, in our mission statement, should I look for anything that directly applies to, and this might point something in a fault towards me, do we need to address things such as our views on abortion or the LGBTQ?
Well, I'll tell you, and I'm just jumping in because of time, but we have done that in our statement of faith, in our ministry statement and values and stuff like that. And we've done that because we realize that you cannot assume anymore that standard conventional classical Christianity is going to be, let me back up and put it this way, that you cannot presume that people will assume that your view is classical Christianity, because so many people who claim to be Christians now are holding views that are clearly un-Christian, non-Christian, you know, that are contrary to Christian teaching. Now we have to step out and say specifically what we believe about abortion and what we believe about human sexuality. And so we have those statements. You can find them on our website. And I think that pastors should do this in part for their own protection, because if an LGBT type person wants to apply for a job at their church and they have not made it clear in their bylaws that this is what they stand for spiritually, then they may have an obligation to hire, or at least an obligation not to deny based on those those issues. And so just for legal reasons, it's important. If pastors are shying away from that, then I'm suspicious on the abortion issue and the LGBT issue, and that all relates to same-sex marriage and the normality, the moral normality of homosexual behavior, and then it makes me wonder about what other sexual behaviors are just fine with a pastor who doesn't want to weigh in on these others. So that's a concern. Look at Tom, I've got to jump out because I've got Christopher in Seattle on board, so I want to chat with him. But I hope that helps
you
a little bit. And yes, you're so welcome. Let's talk with Christopher. Let me get the button here. Okay. There you go,
right.
Chris. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. My question was, how do you pray in the Spirit and how do you talk in the Spirit? Like, how do you speak in tongues? Or is speaking in tongues different from talking in the Spirit? Because when I heard that someone told me once, when I pray out loud, like, everyone hears me. And what I mean by everyone is Satan, demons, angels, God, everybody knows what I'm saying. But when I speak in tongues or when I pray in the Spirit, then nobody knows what I'm saying. It's just between me and God.
Yeah, well, Paul makes a comment to that end in, I think, 1 Corinthians 14, where he talks about this. He also, so this phrase, praying in the Spirit, is characteristically understood by charismatics and Pentecostals as praying in tongues, or using, as they might put it, a prayer language to communicate with God. Of course, in using that, we don't know what we're saying, but God does, presumably based on that theology. Okay, I'm not affirming it necessarily. I'm just saying this is the way they talk about it. This is what they mean. It's not entirely clear to me that praying in the Spirit means that, because we are told to pray in the Spirit, but we are also told that not everyone speaks in tongues. So if we're all to be in the Spirit, pray in the Spirit, whatever that means, but we don't all speak in tongues, then speaking in tongues and praying in the Spirit are not the same thing. If you look at Ephesians chapter 6, and I was just listening. Who was I listening to? Alistair Begg, I think, on this issue. And he was talking about, in Ephesians chapter 6, spiritual armor, spiritual warfare. Paul says, with all prayer, verse 18, with all prayer and petition, pray at all times in the Spirit. And with this in view, be on the alert with all perseverance and petition for all the saints, and pray on my behalf the utterance may be given to me in opening my mouth. Now, what's interesting here, he says pray in the Spirit, but then he gives some content of what we're supposed to pray. So he can't mean praying in the Spirit means praying in tongues when he says pray on my behalf that utterance may be given to me in the opening of my mouth, because you don't know if you're praying in the Spirit, that is praying in tongues, if that's the case. So I don't think the phrase praying in the Spirit always means praying in tongues. And I can't give you a concrete definition of it, except for to say that we're praying consistent with the revelation that the Spirit has given us in the Word, because the Spirit speaks to us directly from the Word. Okay?
Yeah.
And it could mean in praying in the power of the Spirit or in companionship with the Spirit, you know. It could be referring to something like that. But I don't think that what's being referred to here is speaking in tongues because, like I said, Paul says in 1 Corinthians 14, I think, that we don't all do that. Only some do it,
yeah.
And they should do it with an interpreter. Okay, but he says in Ephesians 6 that we ought to all pray in the Spirit. So it must mean something different than speaking in tongues.
And I've been trying to practice, like, you know, speaking in tongues, I guess is what I would call it. But I was considering that as praying in the Spirit. But I, at the same time, I'm having trouble because I don't know if I'm praying in the Spirit with that practice. But, I'm trying.
Well, maybe you're being too introspective about it, okay? I mean, my advice is just for you to go before God with a sincere heart in prayer and pray the kinds of prayers that are consistent with what the Scripture tells you to do. And there's some guidelines here, for example. With a prayer and petition, that means you're talking to God and you're asking for things. that he said, pray in the Spirit with this in view, be on the alert with all perseverance and petition for the saints. So we are to be praying and petitioning on behalf of other Christians, okay? And so he doesn't just leave this praying in the Spirit kind of dangling there with no modifiers or no explanation, but rather he gives some detail there about what are the particular things that our prayer should entail. All right? I acknowledge there's some ambiguity there, but I think if what you're getting stuck on is trying to figure out how to pray in the Spirit as if that's some kind of specialized kind of utterance rather than an attitude or a dependency on the Lord in the Spirit or a trusting, then I think you're just going to run aground in your prayer life. Now, I do know that many Pentecostal types are going to say that means praying in tongues, and that's it. But if that means praying in tongues, then why the detail that we find further there in verse 19 of Ephesians chapter 6? I don't think it is praying in tongues.
Well, thank you.
I'm kind of losing you. I'm sorry, I'm losing you a little bit. A little squeaky in the background there. Go ahead.
Thank you. That helps me out a lot.
It helps?
Yeah.
Is that what you said? Okay, great. Well, I appreciate your call, Christopher in Seattle, and I'm glad that it was helpful. It's a nice way to kind of end the show here. Yeah, that helps a lot. I admit, friends, that prayer is mysterious. In fact, in my own prayer time this morning, I was talking to God about how mysterious prayer is, that I do not understand the calculus of prayer. I don't know how prayer adds up to something that causes God to act. Okay? But one thing I want to make sure is that it will never be said of me, I have not, because I've asked not. All right? And I hope this is true for you too. Greg Kokel here at Stand to Reason. Give them heaven. Bye-bye.